Hello and welcome to another episode of Diabetes Dialogue, Technology, Therapeutics, and Real World Perspectives. Again, coming at you at ADA Sci Sessions in New Orleans. And my name is Diana Isaacs. I am with my wonderful co-host, Natalie Bellini. And we have a very special guest, Dr. Amit Gupta from India. He has many titles and many things that you do. So I'm going to ask you to introduce yourselves and tell our audience a bit about you and all the great things you're doing.
Thank you, Natalia, and thank you, Diana, for having me on this very special episode of Diabetes Dialogue. And so let me just briefly introduce myself. I'm Dr. Amit Gupta. I'm based in New Delhi, India, and I'm a diabetologist. I practice in my clinic, which is Center for Diabetes Care, but I do a lot of work in diabetology and the metabolic health conditions. Currently, I'm leading Global Metabolic Health Alliance as Executive Director. And at International Diabetes Federation, I'm chair of the IDF Education Committee and the School of Diabetes. Working with the ADA in volunteer positions for the last 10 years, and it has been really a phenomenal journey because I meet so many of colleagues, friends, and learn from them. And this has really shaped up my thinking also, where I see diabetes now and where I look to see diabetes and conditions 10 years ago. So it has changed a lot, and I'm really happy that God has given me this opportunity to contribute in some positive way.
Wow.
That's awesome. Yeah.
So where do we even start?
I know. Right? I have so many questions.
I mean, let's start with IDF.
Yeah.
Okay.
Can we start with IDF? Can you tell our listeners what IDF is? Because a lot of people outside the United States don't follow or are less aware of it. So let's start with IDF, and then we're going to dig into India a little bit and what progress you've made there.
So I think IDF, International Diabetes Federation, is one of the biggest organization in the field of diabetes. And it is a federation, so it has more than 250 plus members. And these members are scientific societies as well as the patient-led organizations as well. And it is more than 75 years since IDF was established. And IDF has a very robust leadership, very committed leaders. And currently, Dr. Peter Swartz happens to be the president of the IDF. And IDF is doing a lot of work in terms of writing guidelines, policy, advocacy. And one of the flagship event of IDF, which is now UN endorsed, which was actually proposed by the IDF, is World Diabetes Day, which we all celebrate on or mark on 14th of the November. Many of the educational activities, because I'm leading the IDF Education Committee, so we have IDF School of Diabetes, and IDF School of Diabetes has educational content both for the healthcare professionals as well as the people with diabetes. And these courses cover technology, they talk about retinopathy, they talk about multiple aspects, and similarly, we have platforms where Understanding Diabetes Better is one of the platforms from the IDF itself.
That's amazing. So you have a really good perspective because you're working with people from all over the world. I am so curious how diabetes management, how you've seen it differ, like here in the U.S. compared to India, compared to other parts in the world.
So I think diabetes management varies from country to country, though we have same pathophysiology, we have same drugs which are available, but sometimes these drugs may not be available in every part of the world. Sometimes, for example, US has a lot of new technologies, Europe has a lot of new technologies, and in countries like many Asian countries, including India, these technologies have not yet reached and they are not still there. For example, many of the AIDs which are available in US, they are not still available in country like India. I see there is a difference in the access. You can see the difference in the digital literacy, and also you can see the financial issues, which may also compromise the access to some of the newer medication as well as therapies as well.
Yeah, it's a lot. I mean, it really does vary by country. It depends on what things that public health covers, and it depends on if there's a copay involved or if you have to buy it yourself, what those costs are. And yeah,
we had heard that semaglutide was becoming generic in India. I'm curious if that is true and if that has kind of changed the access to it.
And it's not a rumor. It is now a reality. And semaglutide is now off patent in India. Mm-hmm. And now many companies, they are marketing the generic version of the semaglutide. And this has actually bring down the cost to a very, very, you can say, very affordable level. May not be affording for everyone, but one dose of semaglutide may cost around $3 in India.
Oh, wow.
$3 or $4. So that is the price of semaglutide.
Right. So like $12 a month.
$12 a month, right.
Wow.
So this is the entry point. You can get semaglutide at this level of pricing as well in India now.
Which that's for wild. Some people, they still can't afford. Yeah. But for many, they can.
For many, yes.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
This has changed the access barrier now.
And when we look at molecules like that, that reduce heart attacks and strokes when no one could afford it, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Right. When it is impossible, but this will allow it to be possible.
Yeah. So now we have seen there is a major shift. The people, they are accepting the treatment. They themselves are reaching out, especially for the obesity as well, because obesity is again more than 100 million people in India with obesity. So that is a big number. And there is a lot of awareness around obesity. But now I think the things are going to change in terms of medications. But I believe medications alone cannot be the solution.
Right.
We are in the era of the GLP-1, but GLP-1 cannot be, not everybody would like to have GLP-1, not everybody would like to go in GLP-1. And again, there are two challenges. One is the maintenance of the therapy, then the sustenance of the weight loss. And a large number of people, they take medicines, but they still always think that when they will be off semaglutide.
Yeah. So speaking of that, you mentioned about chairing the Diabetes Education Committee. What are some gaps that you see with diabetes education?
Diabetes education, I think we need to customize it and make it more people-centric. And we need to do the education. Some of the content may be relevant globally, and many of the content we have to customize as per the local needs. For example, need in African countries may be totally different other than the needs maybe in Asia, and the needs may be different in the US as well. For example, let me just highlight, one of my presentation was on talking about idea of perspective and looking at from the lived experience perspective that what are the gaps in the education and how does IDF wish to address this? And so I started with a story in my talk, and I talked about a patient living in New York, one patient living in Asia, one in Africa, and one in, you can say, in China and Asia Pacific region. And I tried to compare that patient in America may be having access to the world-class facilities, excellent healthcare, access to all types of technology, data, dashboards. And opposite may be a person in Africa who has to travel hundreds of kilometers to gain access to a healthcare provider, and a person in India who has still maybe affording but still can wear a CGM maybe two times in a year but doesn't want to wear a CGM. There may be cost-related issues, other issues. But one thing is common among all of them is that they all feel diabetes distress. And they have to take hundreds of decisions daily considering diabetes. So even with the technology, person living in New York needs diabetes education, needs more and more education. Person living in diabetes with Africa needs more, not just education, but other support as well. So I think we need to identify the gaps and then close it, which is relevant to the particular situation.
I agree with you. I think it's very different depending on where you go. I mean, it's very different in the U.S. depending on where you go, right?
Yeah.
We do have people that have very little access. It's kind of like if you're very, very poor or very old, you have pretty decent access. It's the working poor in between, right?
Yeah.
Like I don't want for anything as a clinician with two insurances. You know, that's not. But for the working poor or high deductible plans that we have here, it becomes limited. And it's a hard thing when you have to look at each person walking in and say, you know, no matter what country you're in, what are their resources? Where is their education level? What are they willing to accept? Are they willing to, you know, there's a lot of balance every time you see someone. In general, though, we do see that, you know, when you walk in, where were you before this? You were in some other country, right? Like, and, you know, you go there and you think, okay, how do we solve this? How do we help reduce the burden of diabetes, but also help these people live longer because they're dying younger from the complications because they don't have access to care?
And you are very, I think I completely agree with you. If I would just like to mention that every country has people who may be affording and who may not be affording, who may be having access, may not be having access. So when we talk about different regions and geographies, then idea is that America doesn't mean that everybody is affording and everybody has the access. Mm-hmm. And Africa doesn't mean that everyone is marginalized and they are not having access. So there are challenges. Some takes priorities. But I think we need to be prepared for all types of conditions and settings. And because this is a diabetes dialogue, I would like to highlight that, and we do it for the purpose of the education.
Right.
And so people must understand that there is a difference between information and the education. So getting information from social media is different, but using right information and then using it for your own benefit, using it for the benefit of your patient, then this is education. So I think we need to shift conversation from information to the education as well.
Yeah. Do you have any ideas for creative ways to do that? Because you're absolutely right. People are going to social media and some of the information shared there is really not accurate, and it's becomes a problem for people to get the accurate information.
I think the most important is to get on board people who are creating these platforms. So if we can have Google on board, if we can have Meta on board, if we can have Facebook on board, Insta on board, right from their offices, right from their headquarters, and they start pushing the right information, like if they have Google Health, Samsung Health, that can be the only source, because there are very few doctors or very few healthcare professionals who create the right content, or they have time to create the content and they're passionate about educating. So the people who don't have information, they talk about anything and say, which may not be scientifically correct. So so there is an imbalance between people who are creating the content with not so accurate information and the people who are creating the accurate information. So that is, I think, is a big challenge.
I think that's a really good point, because we're busy seeing patients. We don't have time to be over social media putting, we put out some content, right? We have our podcast, but we don't have the time
to do it
to do it all.
I think too, it's one of those where someone says to me when they come in, I've done my own research. Really, where did you go? Right? Because part of it's where you get your research, where you get your information. And our job as clinicians is to continue to reiterate the science, right? And help that person understand not just what the science says, but how to incorporate that into your life and what that means. I mean, we as clinicians, our job is to protect our, if we're looking at diabetes or MASLD or whatever disease, to protect that person from the ravages of the complications. So our job is to help the person in front of us understand the risk of either having high glucoses or gaining weight in the abdomen or, having high cholesterol without wanting to take a statin, whatever that is, right? Whatever decision that person's making, we have to help them understand the risk of that decision, or that reduction in risk if you do take your statin or you do walk every day or you do, that's education, right? Translating the cholesterol goal less than 70 or less than 50, LDL, though, people with diabetes have a higher risk of heart disease, and this is why. And explaining that education gets that person to go home and swallow the pill or take that injection of semaglutide or whatever other medication we're asking them for.
This is again very interesting, because many of our patients, they do come to us and they say, yes, as I have done my own research, I believe this is true. And there was a very interesting paper which I just read recently, and it talks about when somebody with full misinformation comes to you, how do you handle that? So this paper very well mentions the different steps. If you straight away says that you are wrong.
Right.
Then probably it puts them off and they are not going to accept what you are going to say. So doing it step by step and giving the encountering the misinformation with the right information, providing them the evidence, the background and how the science works can solve the problem. But otherwise simply saying that, no, Google is wrong, you are wrong, why do you go to the social media? Why are you listening to the Instagram? This is not going to solve any of the issue like this.
Right.
Yeah. I'm curious. So in the U.S., I would say we don't have enough diabetes educators, or as we call it, diabetes care and education specialists. How is it in the rest of the world? Are there enough? Is there also kind of a shortage or not enough people?
U.S., I still believe that there is a structured pathway for the CDCS and the other pathways are there, and they exist and the qualification exists. But in many of the part of the world, there is no such qualification that exists. And this is, again, a challenge because, first of all, there is no structured course. And even if you do a structured course, then there is no validation from the government or the policymakers. So it doesn't help them in getting any kind of job security or work security. So this is a challenge in most of the part of the world.
Right. Oh, interesting. Yeah, so I mean, we have a great pathway. It's just that despite that, not many patients don't have access to their own.
So going forward, I think in the most of the settings where such pathways don't exist, so creating diabetes educators without incentive is not going to have a long-term impact. So and having a discussion with the policymakers, bringing them on table and mentioning them that, explaining to them that how does these pathways will help in ultimately bringing down the or improving the health of their people living with diabetes. So this is very important.
Awesome. Any other projects that you're currently working on that you're particularly passionate about right now?
So right now I am working on a project with a team of experts. Not my, I am working. It is a team of people working with the Global Metabolic Health Alliance. And we are trying to create a global consensus framework for the Lifestylers Foundation for Metabolic Health.
Wow.
So as you believe, there are many school of thoughts. They say that lifestyle works, lifestyle doesn't work. But still, there is no harm in having a good lifestyle.
For sure. So, it's essential.
So, yeah.
I'm glad to hear this because I feel like that is often absent from the conversation as we're talking about all the latest and greatest GLP-1 drugs.
And weight loss and those kinds of things. But you're still eating. You're eating less hamburger and french fries, but you're still eating them.
Yeah, right? We can't forget.
More often than we would want you to.
Right. Especially, maintaining muscle mass and the importance of physical activity, which we know has so many tremendous benefits and most people don't get the recommended amount.
And there are challenges with the physical activity also. There was a recent publication in one of the top journals and they talked about that disparity between the access to the physical activity, especially between the, if you compare the gender, when men and women. So women are less likely to have access to the physical activity than the men. So again, it is simply the gender puts you at a disadvantage. So we need to tackle these kind of issues as well.
Wow. That's interesting. Yeah. I guess I could see how that could play out.
Yeah. Leave the house. Right.
Right. Yeah. But there could be access issues. Yeah.
Wow. That's so many things to think about on a global perspective that we don't think about coming from where we are.
Right.
You know? Right.
Right. Well, thank you. This has been a really wonderful conversation. We really appreciate you taking time for us at ADA. And with that, we thank everyone for tuning in to this episode of Diabetes Dialogue, Technology, Therapeutics, and Real World Perspectives.
Thanks, everyone.